You're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Thursday, September 11th. Seven years ago today, our vision of the world changed following the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks of September 11th, 2001. Today, the American worldview has expanded greatly as places like Kabul, the Anbar province, and Islamabad all have entered our nation's collective consciousness. Many of us have even made an attempt to learn what it actually means to be Muslim, while others continue to look at Islam only in black and white terms. For more than 70 years, Cleveland's prestigious Annisfield Wolf Book Award has taken pride in going beyond the black and white when it comes to celebrating cultural diversity and recognizing racism in the United States. And tonight, as this prize, sometimes known as the Black Pulitzer, is handed out to three writers of color in a sold-out ceremony, one of them will know that his expression of what it means to be Muslim in America has been heard. Today around noon, you'll hear from all of the Annisfield Wolf Book Award winners during the hour. But starting us off is Pakistani writer Mohsin Hamid, the author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist. Mohsin, it's a pleasure. Welcome to Cleveland and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Dee.
At the center of your novel are the 9/11 attacks and how the life of your main character, is it Changé?
Cengiz.
Cengiz. See, that's my cultural bias. But Cengiz is forever altered. Before we get to the book, though, I want to talk about what your life was like before and immediately after the attacks.
Well, I'd lived about half of my life in the United States and half in Pakistan. So when I was a child, my father did his PhD in California. So I spent 6 years in the 70s in America. And then I came in 1989 for college, stayed for law school, and worked in New York. In between, I'd been living in Pakistan. So I was half American, half Pakistani on September 11th, 2001. And I had just left America, left New York City, in fact, to move to London a few weeks before the attacks. And when the attacks happened, it seemed to me as though the divide between those two worlds, the Pakistani or Muslim world and the American world, that was opening up in, you know, on the planet, was opening up inside myself as well.
Mm. Did you share your experiences? Did you hear from others, from friends who were experiencing those same kinds of shifts?
I think so. I mean, to give you a sort of an example of this, when I went off to college in the States, a whole bunch of my buddies from Pakistan, from high school, we all went to study in America. And on September 11th, I'd say out of the 10 or 12 good friends I had back home, probably half or more than half of us were living in America, working in America. And today, none of those people are. And these are all liberal, secular, you know, people who love living in the United States. But now, from a combination of circumstances, but partly discomfort being in the United States, they've all gone.
Because people saw them with different eyes or painted them with a same brush or?
Well, I think it was partly that, partly because, you know, up until September 11th, you know, Muslim Americans or Pakistani Americans, it was a hybridized identity like everybody else, like being African American. You didn't really think about it. You know, you were here and you had this other part of your identity and that was fine. After September 11th, when it became this sort of you're either with us or against us, viewpoint, and then wars began to be fought in Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. Plus, you would get stopped at the border. You know, I'd spent hours every time I'd come into the country in secondary inspections at airports. And my wife, who's a smoker, had to, you know, decide whether her love for me was more important than her desire for a cigarette as she waited 5 or 6 hours for them to be done with my questioning. And that was really a true test of our marriage. So I think those things began to add up. I wouldn't say I suffered from any, you know, overly blatant discrimination. But those sorts of things did create the feeling of being very much unwanted. And that coupled with a sense of frustration in U.S. foreign policy really made people feel like, well, maybe this isn't home for us anymore.
Hmm. Your main character, Cengiz, how did you begin to create this character, did the voice sort of begin sounding in your head at some point?
The voice came last. It was interesting because, you know, I started writing a novel in the summer of 2000 after my first novel, Moth Smoke, was published, about a Pakistani man working in corporate America who decides that he needs to leave. And he feels this tension working in, you know, the corporate world, being in America, but being from Pakistan. But it was a very understated, almost like a fable. And then I showed the first draft to it in the summer of 2001. I showed it to my agent. And he said, you know, I don't understand. Why does this Muslim guy feel this conflict with America? And I don't fully buy it. And just a few weeks after September 11th happened, and suddenly these themes that I was exploring in a very quiet, you know, understated way had exploded onto the world stage. And that really drowned out my novel for a long time. It was hard to write that novel when the world was being consumed with this conflict. But eventually I did continue with it and, in fact, incorporated September 11th into it many years later. But I think it really came from something within me. You know, Cengiz isn't me as a character. I'm not Cengiz, that man. Like I said, I've lived half my life in the United States, and he'd just arrived for college. He was much more Pakistani than I was in some senses. But I did feel the tension that Cengiz feels. And I thought, let me create a character that allows me to walk down the road of that tension, perhaps take a fork in that road, which I didn't take. In my own life, I've tried to sort of maintain a balance between things. And I said, well, what if you abandon balance and just walk in one way? And that's what Cengiz became. I've told many people that, you know, who ask me, well, surely he's you, that actually there's a half of me which is an American half, which is the audience for the book, because Cengiz is speaking to an American, but never gets to actually speak in the book itself. But in my own life, my American half speaks very loudly.
Mm. And you mentioned tension, and this book is full of it in an interesting sort of way. I mean, it's because of the structure that you set it up as sort of this long monologue. As a reader, I kept turning pages and thinking, he's way too polite. He's way too, something is sort of being repressed there. And I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. And it's a marvelous device that you came up with.
Well, thank you very much. The starting point for me in writing a novel is I grew up in Pakistan, and almost nobody I knew read literary fiction, let alone, really serious novels. I wanted to find a way, I always try to find a way that makes storytelling really central to what I do, because in a way you have to seduce a reluctant reader, and particularly in Pakistan. So for me in this novel, the idea that, you know, that there's this sort of tension, this thriller component, you know, what's going to happen? Why are we getting nervous? That was really important, to bring the reader on a journey that is thrilling, but also very hopefully unexpected. And the way that the thriller in this novel works is, I think it's probably not giving away too much to say that nothing thrilling actually happens, yet many people have described the book as a thriller. And the reason for that is the novel plays on a basic assumption, which is that the reader is already afraid. And so the reader's fear is what makes the novel thrilling and frightening. And when you reach the end of the novel, without saying what the ending is, what the reader is left with is that fear. And you have to ask the question, you know, is the fear that I take away from this novel something that the author has given me? Or do I have a fear that I need to examine, because it can manifest itself in a very intense way?
Exactly right. I'd love to have you share a passage from the book at this point. And do you need to set up anything before you read?
I'll just read from the very beginning. The way the novel works is that it's entirely a monologue. A Pakistani guy named Cengiz, who has a beard, walks up to an American stranger who we don't know what he's doing in Pakistan and why he's there, and he doesn't know Cengiz. But he walks up to the stranger in a bazaar in Lahore, Pakistan, and starts to speak to him. And this is how Cengiz addresses the American, and this is how the novel begins. "Excuse me, sir, but may I be of assistance? Ah, I see I have alarmed you. Do not be frightened by my beard. I am a lover of America. I noticed that you were looking for something. More than looking, in fact, you seem to be on a mission. And since I am both a native of this city and a speaker of your language, I thought I might offer you my services. How did I know you were American? No, not by the color of your skin. We have a range of complexions in this country, and yours occurs often among the people of our northwest frontier. Nor was it your dress that gave you away. A European tourist could as easily have purchased in Des Moines your suit, with its single vent, and your button-down shirt. True, your hair, short-cropped, and your expansive chest, the chest, I would say, of a man who bench-presses regularly and maxes out well above 225, are typical of a certain type of American. But then again, sportsmen and soldiers of all nationalities tend to look alike. Instead, it was your bearing that allowed me to identify you, and I do not mean that as an insult, for I see your face is hardened, but merely as an observation. Come, tell me, what were you looking for? Surely at this time of day, only one thing could have brought you to the district of Old Anarkali, named, as you may be aware, after a courtesan immured for loving a prince, and that is the quest for the perfect cup of tea. Have I guessed correctly? Then allow me, sir, to suggest my favorite among these many establishments. Yes, this is the one. Its metal chairs are no better upholstered, its wooden tables are equally rough, and it is, like the others, open to the sky. But the quality of its tea, I assure you, is unparalleled.
That's a passage from The Reluctant Fundamentalist, read by Mohsin Hamid, one of this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Award winners. Tonight, Mohsin shares the fiction prize with Juno Diaz, whom we'll hear from next at the sold-out Anisfield Wolf ceremony happening at the Cleveland Playhouse. If you didn't get your ticket to tonight's ceremony, tune in tomorrow night as we broadcast excerpts from the Anisfield Wolf Book Award starting at 8 here on 90.3. Meanwhile, Mohsin, possibly the most controversial part of your book comes when Cengiz is watching the coverage of the 9/11 attacks from his hotel room. Was that section of the book a struggle at all? Was any section a struggle?
Well, you know, the struggle in that, and you know, what's I think shocking about that section is that Cengiz, the main character, feels some degree of pleasure when he sees September 11th happen. He sees these aircraft crashing into these buildings. And at the same time, he knows that it's shameful as a human being to feel this pleasure, but he can't deny that he feels it. And it sets him wondering, you know, why can I be pleased at the notion that thousands of innocent people have just been massacred? You know, am I some kind of monster? And he starts to recognize that there's actually a deep and virulent strain of anti-Americanism in him that he wasn't aware of. That separate from the idea that people have just been killed, there was this symbolic notion that America had just been harmed, and that symbol pleased him. And I've traveled around the world with this book, and it's remarkable how many people in how many different places have come up and told me that they had similar responses to the attacks, which is, you know, and I'm not talking necessarily about Muslims or Pakistanis, it's Australians and, you know, Brazilians and Italians. And I think that notion that as human beings now we can see death on television and not feel humanly connected to the people who've been killed, and also that there is so much resentment against America and the world, really is at the heart of what this novel is about.
Upon returning to the U.S. after the 9/11 attacks, Cengiz makes a slight change to his physical appearance that greatly affects the way others see him. And that's mentioned in that first passage, a beard. Explain how that simple act can cause alarm when it comes to the idea, the appearance of Muslim men to those who have no concept of what's going on.
The easiest way for me to explain what a beard does, if you're a Muslim man or a Muslim-looking man in a country like the United States, what a beard does is something that friends of mine in college used to tell me, African-American friends of mine. And they said, you know, if I go for a job interview and I'm wearing a business suit, I have a completely different reaction when I walk into the nice hotel in which this interview is going to take place. If I walk in jeans and a T-shirt, on the other hand, people look at me totally differently. because they associate that as some, you know, as perhaps I'm more likely to be a criminal as opposed to a hotel guest. Similarly, you know, when you have a beard, and I've kept beards at various times, as a Muslim man in a country like America, there's the instinctual response that, well, maybe you are some kind of fundamentalist and therefore maybe you're violent. Actually, you know, there's no real correlation between those two things. But that symbol, it's a symbol of perhaps refusing to conform to the image which is perceived as non-threatening. Mm. And when somebody who comes from a group that is thought of as being threatening doesn't take upon themselves the effort of making themselves seem unthreatening, the reaction is very negative. And I've seen that at airports, and I've seen that, you know, all over the place.
On the note of symbols, what is this award, the Annisfield Wolf, a symbol of to you?
It's really wonderful. I have to say, I'm extremely pleased to get the award because of who has received it in the past. You know, I'm not an American citizen. I'm a Pakistani citizen and a British citizen. And, you know, I don't have any connection as such with Africa. But I do feel a very strong kinship in particular with African-American writing. I was taught in college by Toni Morrison. I wrote the first draft of my first novel in a creative writing workshop with her. And people like, you know, James Baldwin and Toni Morrison and other, in fact, non-African-American winners like, you know, Edward Said, etc., are hugely important figures for me in my development as a writer. And so to, in some way, be honored as following in their footsteps is enormously satisfying, because this book for me is a very American novel. It's about America. And to be included in an American award, a book about, award for, you know, about race in America, makes me feel like I've sort of, you know, come home to my literary roots.
Well done, in all senses of that phrase. Thank you so much for being part of our program today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mohsin Hamid, the author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist, and tonight he accepts the Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Fiction in a sold-out ceremony at the Cleveland Playhouse. The Reluctant Fundamentalist is out now in paperback, published by Harcourt Books. For more on the Annisfield Wolf Awards or Mohsin Hamid, log on to our homepage today online at WCPN.org, where you can hear the program on demand. Coming up, from Pakistan to Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic, we raise the curtain on the brief and wondrous life of Oscar Wao with its Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Juno Diaz. He joins me as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
This is 90.3 WCPN. Idea Stream.
Welcome back. You're tuned to a special edition of Around Noon on 90.3. Tonight, the most recent winners of the internationally known literary prize, the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, will be honored in a sold-out ceremony at the Cleveland Playhouse. On today's show, we celebrate the achievements of those winners who've shown us the many faces of diversity through their writing. Joining us now in the Idea Center at Playhouse Square is another of tonight's honorees, Juno Diaz, whose debut novel, The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, has garnered not only an Annisfield Wolf Award, but a Pulitzer Prize, a National Book Critics Circle Award, and a Sargent First Novel Prize. Juno, congratulations on all of the above, and welcome. It's good to have you here.
Dee, thank you so much for having me.
Now, even though this is your first novel, your short story writing's been winning praise and readers for several years. Did any of the characters and situations you describe in Oscar Wao appear in your short fiction?
Yes, no, this is the same family. I tend to be working on we're not the same family, the same narrator. I tend to be using this narrator, Junior de las Casas, and he appears in both books.
Ah. And the tale you tell is presented in several non-traditional ways. But before we talk about the structure, I wonder, have you shed some light on that family, on Oscar's family, and what it's important to know about him and them?
Well, I think part of the novel, part of what drove me to write the book is this idea of a family attempting to find a home in the new world. I mean, this is one of the oldest quests that we have in the Americas. People who have been dislocated, people who have been enslaved, people who have been transported, people who have left their homes and come here, people who have been nearly wiped out. In the end, that's just a journey that the Americas, in some ways, it defines the Americas, a search for home. And by extension of home, of course, is a search for love and for intimacy. And the book is about a family, a Dominican family in central New Jersey, a mother, a daughter, and a son. And all of them are searching for home and searching for love, but especially Oscar, the youngest son, the brother, who's this huge, overweight, awkward, incredibly intellectual, incredibly nerdy, and very sensitive young man.
Mm. The story is told through multiple narrators' voices. You mentioned Junior as one, but there is Lola as well, Oscar's sister, who tells part of the story. And I was curious about whose voice you heard most clearly as you were beginning to construct the novel.
Well, that's a really good question. Anyone who grows up in a big family, I grew up in a big family. I have five siblings. I grew up with my mother's two sisters, my aunts. I grew up with my grandparents. We were raised together in an extended clan. And so when I hear voices, the very grammar of hearing voices in my own head is always multiple. I never hear one voice. I constructed not Oscar, not his sister, not Belicia, their mother, but I actually constructed the entire family together as a unit.
Ah, oh, that's interesting. And so they're all born at the same time, and they're all sort of struggling for their place in the sun as you're rolling out their stories.
Well, I can't imagine anyone coming. I can't imagine anyone understanding me or my siblings or my mother without getting the context of the voices that surrounded them, that surrounded us. I feel like I only make sense as a person if you actually hear my sisters. When you hear my sisters, suddenly you're like, oh my God, I know why you're the way you are.
Well, have you thought much about that? I mean, what way are you? How do you describe yourself as a person in the world?
Again, I think that's something that's I have no access to. You know, describing yourself is difficult because of the blind spot that is yourself, and also because of narcissism and of your own personal myths. I think my siblings would do a much better job of describing who I am than I could possibly do. I mean, I know I'm gloomy, and I know that, like, I'm seriously optimistic about the future of the African diasporic peoples. But beyond that, I don't get a good sense of myself, you know. I pay my bills. You know, my friends can knock on my door any hour of the night, and I will happily let them in. But
those add up to at least a picture of the sensibility, the mind that created this book. And the music that we opened with came from a band that has Dominican roots. They're making a big splash on the scene these days. And I mention that because your book is packed with insight into Dominican culture. Are those insights that you were able to find in any other mainstream media? They were unfamiliar to me.
Well, I mean, the Dominican Republic was nearly annexed to the United States in the 1860s, the annexation of the Dominican Republic failed by one vote. You can, the fact that the Dominican Republic is in the 51st state is all due to the great Charles Sumner, the senator who scuttled this. The history of the Dominican Republic is intrinsically linked to the United States. It's not just military occupations, of which the United States has had a few in the Dominican Republic and on the island in general. What I've always been struck is by, despite sort of the way our histories have been intertwined, this tiny little island, the first country in the New World, and this enormous superpower, the last country in the New World, there's very little information about Santo Domingo. And so part of what I was interested in was thinking about sort of producing the context that made both countries possible. What's kind of ironic is the United States could never have become the United States had it not been for the experience of the Caribbean, the experience of the Dominican Republic. And I felt it was very important for both nations to be aware of how much they share.
And you share a fair amount of Dominican history, and especially the history of a Dominican dictator, Rafael Trujillo. I love the way you incorporate that information in these footnotes at the bottom of a lot of pages, and I was curious about why you decided to break up the narrative that way.
Well, first of all, the footnotes is something I stole from another Caribbean writer, Patrick Chamoiseau, one of my favorite writers of all time. I think perhaps one of the greatest living writers, at least one of the, in my flawed estimation, probably one of the top four great living writers. And he always used footnotes as this, not as a way to reinforce erudition or reinforce authority, but as a way to even undercut his own narrative. It's almost like he could get a second voice, because this is what it sounds like to me when I'm in a Caribbean environment and someone's telling a story. There's always someone there to say, you know what, to adjust your story for you. It's like it's the oral version of yoga. There's always someone there to adjust your position to show you that you've got it right. And I wanted to have this second voice because it made the narrative feel more alive. But more importantly for me, I wanted the footnotes not to deliver historical information, though they do that. I wanted them there in a way to fight with the main text. You know, it was like having that grumpy uncle who won't let you finish a story. And that felt much more real to me.
Right. And that's exactly what happens. I found myself getting caught up in the footnote and then saying, where was I before? And sort of scanning the pages ahead and saying, oh, man, I hope there are more footnotes coming. Because it was just fun to take those detours and then come back to sort of the main road that you're going down at any given time. I'm wondering if you could share a passage with us with or without footnotes.
Sure. No, I would. I will just share one of the earliest footnotes. Why don't we do that? It seems probably a wise way to proceed. I just was going to read a footnote that begins part of the book, and it's for those of you who missed your mandatory 2 seconds of Dominican history. Rafael Trujillo, one of the 20th century's most infamous dictators, ruled the Dominican Republic between 1930 and 1961 with an implacable, ruthless brutality. A portly, sadistic, pig-eyed mulatto who bleached his skin, wore platform shoes, and had a fondness for Napoleon-era haberdashery, Trujillo came to control nearly every aspect of the Dominican Republic's cultural, social, and economic life through a potent mixture of violence, intimidation, massacre, rape, co-optation, and terror, treated the country like it was a plantation, and he was the master. At first glance, Trujillo was just your prototypical Latin American caudillo, but his power was terminal in ways that few historians or writers have ever truly captured, or I would argue, imagined. He was our Sauron, our Oron, our dark side, our once and future dictator, a personaje so outlandish, so perverse, so dreadful that not even a sci-fi writer could have made his ass up. Famous for changing all the names and all the landmarks in the Dominican Republic to honor himself, for making ill monopolies out of every slice of the national patrimony, for messing around with every hot girl in sight, even the wives of his subordinates, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of women, for insisting on absolute veneration from his pueblo. Outstanding accomplishments include the 1937 genocide against the Haitian and Haitian-Dominican community, one of the longest, most damaging U.S.-backed dictatorships in the Western Hemisphere, the creation of the first modern kleptocracy. Trujillo was Mobutu before Mobutu was Mobutu. the systematic bribing of American senators, and last but not least, the forging of the Dominican peoples into a modern state.
Those are the words of author Junot Diaz. He's my guest today, and he was just reading a passage from his multi-award-winning first novel, The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. Tonight, Juno will be on hand for the ceremonies honoring this year's winners of the Annis Field Wolf Book Awards. And that ceremony at the Cleveland Playhouse is sold out. So if you can't make it to tonight's event, or you just want to re-experience it, you can tune in tomorrow night at 8 when we share highlights from the evening. That's the Annis Field Wolf Award Ceremony, Friday night at 8 on 90.3. Meanwhile, we continue our conversation with Juno Diaz, who joins me in Studio 4 of the Idea Center for today's Around Noon. There was a moment in the last few minutes when you mentioned science fiction, and I wanted to put on the table the fact that one of the ongoing themes in the book is Oscar's obsession with and your obvious vast knowledge of science fiction and fantasy writing. And I wanted to ask first if that's been a lifelong passion for you, and second, how you think it jives with Oscar's and your Dominican identity.
Well, it's not a lifelong passion. I gave up science fiction and fantasy and all sorts of nerd things when it was time to chase after girls. And I only came back to it after I realized that, you know, it was something that I kind of missed and that I probably should never have, like, given up just sort of to become popular or for social, you know, gains. I was, like, a bit of a traitor to my own self. But I do think that it's interesting the way that science fiction and fantasy and what we could call in comic books, what we would call the genre, play out in the United States, play out in the popular culture. For someone who's Caribbean, for someone who is the product of New World chattel slavery, for someone who's the survivor or the child of survivors of these insidious and nightmarish dictatorships, which the New World has many of, for someone who is an immigrant who jumped in a matter of hours from a third world country to central New Jersey, narratives like science fiction and fantasy are not only possible sources of consolation. They also, as just a narrative, can explain the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, how does anyone with polite, realistic discourse explain slavery? I mean, how do you explain it? How can you really capture the enormity of this project, the breeding of people to become workers? You don't see it talked about much in polite discourse. When it's time to write about it, you have to, like, make a big deal. This is the slavery novel. And yet comic books, science fiction, fantasies are obsessed with these issues almost as a casual thing. And I felt that these narratives have a very good way, are very capable of explaining the Caribbean, of explaining the deep history of the New World in ways that other forms couldn't. Yeah. Oscar just likes science fiction because he's a nerd. The person creating this book sees science fiction as a lens to understand how the world became the world after the crimes and the horrors and the things that happened in the New World.
It's a really thrilling lens to be looking through, and I thank you so much for sharing that way to open a lot of eyes. Thank you.
No, thank you for having me.
My guest has been Juno Diaz, one of the winners of this year's Annis Field Wolf Book Award. Those awards will be delivered tonight at a sold-out ceremony that begins at 6:30 at the Bolton Theater of the Cleveland Playhouse. And we remind you that this Friday night at 8, 90.3 will bring you the recorded highlights from tonight's Annis Field Wolf Ceremony, so be sure to tune in. And do stay with us this hour, as up next we share a conversation with the award's Lifetime Achievement winner. Meanwhile, you can find out more about Juno Diaz and his award-winning first novel, The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, online at WCPN.org, where you can hear today's show on demand. It's 13 minutes before 1 o'clock as you're tuned to Around Noon here on 90.3. Between the years 1962 and 1970, the experience of African Americans in the United States underwent a sea change. The civil rights stream of integration was starting to dissipate as a new radical Black Power movement began to arise. Straddling this exciting and antagonistic era of American history was a New York writer who wasn't afraid to hold up a mirror to the myths of our society, both Black and white. With a Harvard education and a biting sense of humor, William Melvin Kelly penned some of the classics of the Black Arts Movement, A Different Drummer in 1962, A Drop of Patience in 1965, and his surrealistic masterpiece from 1967, Dem. Tonight, William Melvin Kelly accepts the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Cleveland Playhouse for the 73rd Annual Anisfield Wolf Book Award Ceremony. William Melvin Kelly, also known as Duke, joins me now in Studio 4 of the Idea Center in Playhouse Square. Duke, it's an honor to meet you. Thank you so much for being part of our show.
Thank you very much.
I was reading that you were born in the Bronx and grew up in an Italian neighborhood. What are some memories of that time for you and your family?
Well, at that time, you know, Italians were not considered white. White people were really English people and Scandinavian people. And the Italians were just beginning to assimilate and take on. So we had a lot in common, and they were very kind to me and protective of me. And I'll tell you a story. A kid came into the neighborhood from an Irish gang and called me a nigger. So my friends caught him, brought him to me and said, "Go on, Billy, beat him up." And now my mother had told me that anybody who called me nigger was an ignorant person and that I should dismiss it. So I told them, "No, my mother doesn't want me to fight." And, you know, but they said, Duke, and they, not Duke, they called me Billy. Billy, you know, we got to beat him up. He insulted you. I said, no, I don't want to do it. So they beat him up.
On your behalf.
On my behalf. Mm. So they were very, I'm still friendly with one of those guys who was grew up to be a fireman. And I recently took him to see a cricket match because he'd seen some cricket in Bermuda and he wanted to know what it was all about. So I took him.
You teach creative writing these days at Sarah Lawrence College. How and when did you first start writing?
I went to Harvard, and I went as a lawyer. But when I got to Harvard, I realized that I had tremendous reading difficulties that I had masked with charm and phonographic ear. I could remember just about everything that was said. So I went to all my classes, and I remembered everything. They would give you 100 pages. Each class would give you 200 pages to read each week. And so month by month, week by week, I fell more and more behind, and I realized that I was not going to be a lawyer. My faculty advisor would come home with these 6-8-inch thick books, and I knew I would never get through them. I'd always been interested in art, all kinds of art, and I'd narrowed down to 3, acting and painting and writing. And I finally made the choice based on the fact that writing was the cheapest. I didn't particularly like the people in the theater. They were all as egotistical as I was. And painting was, it was about 6 years before acrylics. And so it was all oil paint and tremendously expensive, $20 paint, you know, tubes and $30 brushes and all that. So I just knew I couldn't afford that. So I just said, okay, I'll go on and write. And my father had been a writer. He was a journalist and had been the editor before I was born of the Amsterdam News for 11 years. So, you know, I came by it naturally. But I think it was also because I had a grandmother who had identified me as the family historian. You know, every generation of an African-American family has some kid who's interested in the family history, and the old person is the one, oh, okay, this is the one I'll tell. And she told me this tremendously elaborate story about this Confederate colonel and the fact that before he'd been a Confederate colonel, he'd knocked up this young Haitian slave girl, and she had a daughter, and the daughter grew up to be the mistress of the gunsmith in Savannah, Georgia. And so I had this whole story. Then my grandmother came north, at, you know, she was one of those children, came north and married a kind of a Puerto Rican radical. And so I had all these stories in me. And so when I started to write, I just had all these stories to write. So,
You adapted your grandmother's stories and added...
I've written various things about them. There are two or three stories in my story collection, which is similar. My grandfather, Narciso Garcia, he went into a bar one time and they refused him, Irish bar, and they refused him service. And he kept saying, hey, I want a drink. And finally they gave him the drink. But after he finished the drink, they broke his glass. And he jumped over the counter and broke 100 more glasses and smashed the mirror, went off to jail, somehow got out, you know. But I was growing up with stories like that. And, and then the Civil War story, of course.
Would you share a passage with us from something that you've written?
Yes, definitely. This is a story about a man, Carlyle Bedloe. I've been writing about him ever since I began writing, and I've been aging him. I wrote about him as a teenager, and then I wrote about him as a man in his 20s. And here, I guess he must be around 40 years old, between 40 and 50. He's got two women that he loves. He loves them both. One is a Caribbean woman, and the other is a woman from Harlem. And he kept them separately, kept them separate for a long time, but somehow or other, they learned about each other, and the kids learned about each other. And the kids got quite close, as you'll see. So they kept talking to him about each other. And so finally, he decided that he would get them together in the hope that they could somehow work out the relationship so that he could have a little peace. I guess I'll start there. I have a little time, I guess. Carlyle arranged to have both meet him on a Tuesday evening at one of Harlem's few remaining gems, the Golden Grouse Bar and Restaurant. He liked breakfast better than dinner at the Grouse, but did not expect anybody to eat very much. However, red-clad Gloria tipped in first and quickly ordered an immense fried chicken dinner with scalloped potatoes and tossed salad and peach cobbler, and the Grouse's special punch. Before her food had arrived, Senegal, the other woman, appeared in olive drab, her dreadlocks wrapped out and back like a praying mantis in the national's colors. She carried various tubs of her own Ital delicacies because she did not trust the cook at the Grouse to keep the bacon grease out of the peanut oil. The two women sat silently glaring across the table at each other and consumed all that the waitress and Senegal had carried to the table. Near the end of the 30-minute meal, Senegal sampling the peach cobbler and Gloria quenching her thirst with the homemade ginger beer. Together they covered their belches and tittered. Then they both put fire under his sorry brown butt. Thought the sight of this simple country cow pie would do what? Make I tell all the world that this I woman never fear no old higgler till yet, nor see it. Sure don't see what jive hustle he think he pulled with this tired BS, but this sister came a long way to tell everybody that this just won't go down. Because I love that I woman keeping for said man spring from the most high mountain of New Zion. Besides, this brother have himself deluded into thinking that because I love him, that mean I need him, when he too dim to see I got my own house on Barnes Avenue in the Bronx, all bought and paid for with mops and tips, and also got by far the best of his never-do-nothing buttocks in his daughter Carlotta, which I sister can strenuously affirm and illustrate as him give I woman nothing of value but sweet little Molly, and she quite valuable. They glowered at him. Now what, bumbersucker? I just wanted to see if we all couldn't maybe find a way to get along, Carlyle said simply. I can't help myself, but I love you both, and I've been mainly true to you two for the past 10 years. He heard and despised the quiet desperation in his voice. I mean, the kids don't seem to defend each other. The women agreed. Them two picnic itch up like sea and sun to see it. Looking so cute and flying, their little matching outfits, hooking it up on the phone. When this fool think he's sneaking them out on the sly to take them someplace like my child don't come tell her mama everything that be going on, Turkey. All the while, them a burn up phone wire to see it, talking about my sister this and my sister that. Call out to why and call out to what for. And many times Carlotta have said, Mommy, why can't Molly spend the night? Well, they both certainly agreed to that arrangement.
The words of William Melvin Kelly, also known as Duke, who will take home the Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Lifetime Achievement. I wish we had more time to talk about that life, but it's been such a privilege and a pleasure to have you in the studio today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Tonight, that ceremony gets underway at 6:30. If you don't have a ticket, tune in tomorrow night at 8 to 90.3 as we share highlights. For today, our thanks to the Plain Dealer, Eric Wellman tomorrow morning, who will be sharing a literary view of the Annisfield Wolf ceremony. And thanks as well to Jeff Carlton, to Laura Scharf of Landau, and to Dave DiOrio for his production of today's program. I'm Dee Perry. Stay tuned for the next hour, as 7 years after September 11th is the center of discussion for the BBC's World Have Your Say on 90.3.